Heads up, fans of the world. We're putting a little something extra in your feed. Things That Go Boom, a bonus podcast to loyal listeners of the world from PRX. Things That Go Boom. Let's roll.
So I know one girl whose name was Sushi because she likes sushi so much.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And I know this other guy, his name is Broken.
Oh.
Because at the time, he just broke up with his girlfriend and he felt heartbroken. So that's his name.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's so sad.
In China, some people give themselves English names. It's a tonal language.
Ma, 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 ma.
And historically, some Westerners have either failed or just flat out refused to learn how to pronounce Chinese names.
So your name is Connie. That's your English name. How did you choose that?
Well, Connie was actually my second English name. I had another one when I was in middle school, in high school.
Huh.
My first name was Juliet.
This is Connie Mae Pickert, formerly Juliet.
Because I was in love with Leo.
Oh.
We were all in love with Leonardo DiCaprio.
And Leo was Romeo. Gosh. He was Romeo in Romeo and Juliet, so
I loved that movie so much.
Yeah.
Thus from my lips, by thine, my sin is purged.
And have my lips the sin that they have took?
Sin from my lips? O trespass, sweetly urged, give me my sin again.
Is it common, very common for folks to use their English names in China?
It's very common for my generation.
Connie was born in the 80s.
But it's not quite the same with this younger generation born in the 90s. I noticed that a lot of these younger folks, they just use their Chinese names when they speak English or when they communicate with foreigners.
Huh. Is there actually a resistance to using an English name?
I think so. I think a lot of that is done consciously because the younger generation has a lot more cultural confidence, I would say. So when they communicate with foreigners, they feel like, you know, I have a name. You know, it may be difficult for you to pronounce, but I'm going to use it anyway. You just have to learn it.
Yeah, figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Lacey Healy, and this is Things That Go Boom, your friendly neighborhood national security podcast. Today, with China's rise has come greater confidence. And in some ways, that's great. We should all have the right to use our own names. But it's also come with a new wave of nationalism and more authoritarian ways, like amped up surveillance and censorship.
More than a million Uyghurs and others are believed to be detained in
China calls them thought transformation camps.
I love the Communist Party of China, this man has written.
Meanwhile, in the U.S.
They don't want these protesters to be there, even though they were peaceful.
Back up!
President of law and order.
I can't breathe!
Some have wondered whether we ourselves might be slipping into a less democratic style of government.
What you do in an authoritarian regime is you delegitimize the press.
And we're reckoning with our own failures as a democracy, especially where racial justice is concerned. So as China moves to assert itself on the world stage and in Hong Kong, and the U.S. struggles with foundational values like liberty and justice for all, we wondered, is democracy losing? In politics, people often tell you not to get lost in the weeds. But The Weeds by Vox is a podcast for people who love the weeds. Because that's where politics becomes policy, the stuff that shapes your life and the lives of the people you care about. Every week, Matthew Iglesias is joined by a variety of leading Vox voices and policy experts to dig into the weeds on important issues. So, if you're the kind of person that likes to dive deep into the weeds, or you just want to keep up with the current political landscape, this show is for you. Subscribe to The Weeds for free right now in your favorite podcast app to get new episodes automatically from Vox and the Vox Media Podcast Network. Connie Mae Pickert has thought a lot about China's rise and the nationalistic tone seeping into her homeland. And it's cost her. But before we get to all that, we have to go back to 1972. When President Richard Nixon famously traveled to China, cracking the ice on two decades of estrangement between the two countries.
Our talks have been characterized by frankness, by honesty, by determination, and above all, by mutual respect.
Just a few years later, China's chain-smoking leader Deng Xiaoping kicked off something called reform and opening up, relaxing economic controls and carefully opening the door to the rest of the world. Flash forward to 1990s China, bicycles still rule the streets, but the first McDonald's are also just beginning to appear. And Connie is growing up on a steady diet of Friends and Seinfeld. She's listening to a lot of American music, too.
I mean, 90s is also, in China, you know, it was a decade of cassettes, cassette tapes. And I can get these cheap cassettes from wholesale markets.
So there's young Connie with her Walkman on, listening to what Chinese young people are referring to as classical European and American music.
By classical, they mean like 80s Hollywood music. So that's where you know, songs like Yesterday Once More.
It's Yesterday Once More.
Then I got into Backstreet Boys.
Oh, yeah.
Right Here Waiting by Richard Marx.
Whatever it takes, or how my heart breaks.
Those were overplayed. And that's the kind of music I grew up in.
So Connie grew up with Richard Marx, but she also grew up with Karl Marx. She had a patriotic education at school to promote loyalty to the Communist Party of China. And she studied Mao's Little Red Book. Mao founded the People's Republic of China and oversaw the country's resurgence. But he also enacted brutal campaigns like the Cultural Revolution that stressed conformity and control. Today, China's kind of a strange political animal. It kept its state-run communist system, but it also hung a shingle on the door and opened for business. It's kind of a communist-capitalist hybrid, a socialist country with almost 400 billionaires. Mao Zedong's old Shanghai home is now part of a glitzy shopping mall. Now in the 90s, with Connie and her Walkman, reform and opening up brought high hopes for a political opening, too. Conventional Western wisdom assumed that, inevitably, democracy would follow. After all, who doesn't love democracy? A government by the people, for the people, elections, an independent judiciary, freedom of speech. In 1993... even the Peace Corps was invited to China. It seemed like a promising sign.
There's a lot of engaging discussions among students about, you know, pretty sensitive topics about politics and other things.
Sensitive topics like the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre, where thousands of student protesters were killed in the bloody military crackdown. Today, that piece of history is taboo in China. You can't even mention it on social media. But in 2003... Connie learned all about it from a pretty critical Western documentary that was just available to watch at her elite Beijing University.
Even after the soldiers opened fire, many people couldn't believe they were using live ammunition.
A student I knew practically crawled out from under the tank. Two of his classmates were crushed.
It wasn't just controversial Chinese history that bubbled up in the 90s. Hollywood blockbusters with all their Western decadence were on offer, too.
So early on, I guess, I got interested in language as well as American culture, you know, watching movies like Titanic.
In case you missed that, another Leonardo DiCaprio reference.
That was the movie. That was the movie. That was the moment that I was like, that's it. I'm going to America.
Oh, well, I get that.
Yeah. I was like, okay, I really need to meet Leo. So I'm going to study English even harder. And eventually, I'm going to go to California and meet him.
Connie graduated in 2007, and she headed straight for the United States. Not actually to Hollywood, but to Washington State University to get her master's. Plot twist, her future husband actually traveled with her. They were dating at the time and serious enough to move to the States together. So, sorry, Leo. I guess she never really had a chance after all. When Connie moved back to China in 2015, Shanghai was a bustling metropolis with glistening new skyscrapers, shopping malls, and Apple stores. Chinese buyers were consuming so much they were driving up the cost of art and fine wine. But Connie also found government propaganda posters everywhere.
It changed?
It changed, yes. It changed quite a bit. They deem that the stability, social stability, is a priority for the country.
Specifically, you know, with regard to rising nationalism or things that, that had changed politically, were there things that you noticed immediately?
The things I noticed immediately is probably censorship. I have this American professor friend who teaches at a university in Shanghai, and he told me that he was given a list of things that he cannot discuss in class. And of course, that includes the three T's, Taiwan, Tibet, and Tiananmen.
And what about propaganda or surveillance? Had those increased in the time that you were away?
Yes. Growing up in this system, I mean, censorship or propaganda, that's nothing new to me. But when I came back, things seemed to be like on a completely different level. There's just more ubiquitous propaganda, you know, posters, news programs, and they're also becoming more sophisticated. That's what I noticed. There are rap videos being made about, you know, congressional meetings in Beijing.
Imagine a rap video about the Republican Congressional Caucus. There was even a slick talk show called Marx Got It Right, aimed at indoctrinating China's millennials. Online chats were monitored for anything that might be deemed threatening to stability. And at one point, Connie was censored. She was blocked for 3 full days from the popular WeChat app. She thinks it was because of comments she made about a standoff with South Korea over the deployment of a U.S. anti-military system. But she never knew for sure. That's part of the intimidation. So then I guess you kind of have to tell your colleagues as well that you were blocked, which is, I don't know if that's something you would want to have to do.
I did. I actually did tell my, I told them I was putting WeChat jail.
Yeah. Okay. Very nice. Then it got personal.
But nationalism has found its way among my friends as well.
Connie wrote about it for the SubChina news outlet. Her article is called Nationalism Ruined My Chinese Friendships. Connie read me an excerpt describing dinner with a friend. They'd just had a heated political discussion.
So toward the end of my dinner with Mingjun and other friends, she suggested I download an app called 学习强国, literally translated as study to strengthen the country. The platform is overseen by the government's propaganda department, which produces instructional content for the general public and party members in particular. The app's content ranges from CCP history to Xi Jinping's most recent speech, from Chinese medicine to tourist attractions. This way, Mingjun told me, you can familiarize yourself with China's perspective and hopefully correct your Western bias.
Connie's oldest friends seem willing to overlook some major human rights abuses, like the massive forced detention and, quote, re-education of Muslim Uyghurs in the Xinjiang region. They'd say this was justified for national security. And when Connie disagreed, they'd imply that she'd been brainwashed in the United States. Or worse, they'd just go quiet.
It seems like I am not speaking the Chinese language, because I'm not agreeing with, you know, with their nationalist sentiment. They just come from a point of view where we Chinese think this, and, you know, we think that we're better, we're doing a great job, etc. And when I came out being critical, I was never literally ostracized. My friends, I mean, that's people I grew up with. They just stopped responding to any of my comments. And that's what it hurts. They just automatically put me in a different camp, feeling, you know, that I am speaking on behalf of the enemy.
Connie realized that there was no room for debate anymore. China wasn't looking for the political engagement that Nixon had tried to script into history when he made his famous visit in 1972. Going forward, China would write its own script, at home and, increasingly, around the world.
Ah!
In the fall of 2019, the People's Republic of China celebrated its 70th anniversary with its biggest ever military parade. The scene is spectacular. Row upon row of soldiers march in perfect formation down the steps of the Monument to the People's Heroes as cannon fire fills the air. But the showstoppers that day were a bit more cutting edge than cannons.
There was the Sharpsword combat drone and a hypersonic missile, a sleek dart that flies at more than 5 times the speed of sound.
Having recently put an end to term limits, President Xi Jinping looks on from the exact spot where Mao declared the country's founding. And just to be sure we don't all miss the symbolism of the moment, he wears a black Mao-like suit. Xi tells his audience, no force can stop the advance of the Chinese people and the Chinese nation. It seemed like a pretty big break from China's past strategy of hide your strength and bide your time. It also seemed to hark back to something Xi said a year earlier at a party congress, when he presented the China model as, quote, a new option for other countries. You might say, an alternative to democracy.
Well, certainly we've seen over the last years a resurgence of autocracy with dictators who once would have felt that they are weird aberrations.
That's Yasha Monk, a political scientist at Johns Hopkins University and the author of The People versus Democracy.
They now feel emboldened and they say, no, you know what, actually, perhaps we have a future after all. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly true of people like Vladimir Putin in Russia, and it may be true of the leadership in China as well.
Yasha says, when other countries look at China, well, 4 decades of unstoppable economic growth certainly helps to sell the message that its model is working. Just look at the numbers. The World Bank says China has lifted more than 850 million people out of poverty since opening its economy in the late 1970s. Low wages and dangerous factory jobs, those were part of the bargain, but still.
Those are people who may not have had running water, would not have had stable electricity, would often have gone hungry, weren't able to access a high-quality education, or in some cases, any real education at all. And so it's unsurprising that there's a lot of people who fit that description who have a reservoir of trust for the political system.
And if you lived through the Cultural Revolution, like Connie's parents did, you may just be grateful for political stability. Full stop. No matter what the price tag. Of course, there is some limited dissent on the mainland. And protests against the regime had become a constant fixture in Hong Kong, at least until recently, when Beijing enacted a new security law that severely restricts political and civil rights.
This was the moment China tightened its grip on Hong Kong.
This is unprecedented. They're basically going above local authorities and saying...
The acts of protest that have rocked Hong Kong over the past year could now be classed as subversion or secession and punished with up to life in prison.
But then, America's democratic ideal isn't standing quite as strong as it once was. When Beijing sees Trump talking about dominating protesters in front of the White House, it looks hypocritical. In just one example, recently, a U.S. State Department spokesperson called for freedom-loving people around the world to stand with Hong Kong. He did this on Twitter. A spokesperson from China's foreign ministry responded, "I can't breathe." And it's not just China. This kind of thing looks hypocritical to a lot of the world, Americans included. Yasha's own research supports this. He says while populists and autocrats are having a moment in other parts of the world, people right here in the United States are also growing dissatisfied with democracy. His research shows that more than 2/3 of older Americans consider it absolutely essential to live in a democracy. But skip down to millennials, and less than 1/3 feel that way.
And what we found was that younger Americans are much less likely to say it's really important to live in a democracy than older Americans, that a lot more younger Americans say that they like the idea of army rule or of a strong system of government, a strongman leader who doesn't have to bother with parliament or elections. And that was a pretty shocking finding.
Huh.
tanks. And I said, well, wait a minute. Under the normal rules, I'll be out in 2024. So we may have to go for an extra term. Okay? Oh, they're going crazy. They're going crazy.
And all of this is part of a larger trend. If you look at the Democracy Index, which is compiled by the Economist Intelligence Unit, it offers a snapshot of the health of democracy around the world by asking a series of simple questions, like, are press freedoms being protected? Then it provides rankings. And last year, North Korea was at the bottom, Norway was at the top, and the U.S. came in 25th in the flawed democracy category. But the global average also fell to the worst level since the index started 13 years ago. In short, democracy is stalling. To this point, there was something that Connie said that stuck with us. She said, you can't chalk up her friend's loyalty to the Chinese government to slick propaganda alone. Her friends are not brainwashed, and they're not willing to forgive every misdeed as long as the government makes them rich either. It's actually more troubling than that. She told us how she was on another one of these chat groups with a girlfriend, and Hong Kong came up.
And people are saying, you know, this is old news now because it's been going on for months. So let's not talk about this anymore. Let's instead talk about Double 11.
Double 11, as in the date November 11th.
Which is a major online shopping event in China.
Like Black Friday?
Yes, yes, exactly like Black Friday. Yeah, they agree. Let's talk about Black Friday or, you know, Double 11 instead.
Right. I get it. It's a whole lot easier to talk about shopping than, say, judicial independence in Hong Kong. But then Connie's friend added,
because what is democracy in the end? It's the powerless and the dispossessed fantasizing power and money being shared with them. In a sense, it's very much like communism. And another person said, yes, indeed. Democratic or socialist, each system has its own way of fooling people, but we're past the point of believing in any of them. Don't just draw the bread on paper, give us real bread.
Winston Churchill actually said something similar. That democracy, quote, is the worst form of government, except for all of those other forms that have been tried from time to time. In the end, Connie's friends weren't just cynical about the Chinese system. They were cynical about the U.S. system, too.
So do they see, you know, the Chinese system as an alternative to democracy? Yes, yes, because they don't believe in either of them. And, you know, as a cynical and disgruntled ordinary citizen, what can they do about it? So what they focus on really is just, you know, tending to their financial needs and just keeping your head low.
It's easier to just go shopping. But Yasha says there are plenty of examples throughout history where people living under dictators and authoritarian regimes were willing to keep their heads low and play along until they weren't.
We've seen in human history that dictatorships have proven very unstable.
Meaning they often collapse. A fate that experts say could be worse than China's rise. After all, who wants to see a country of 1.4 billion people who are also important customers for thousands of businesses suddenly fail?
Even after years of economic growth, 1 year of economic stagnation still poses a big risk of political instability within dictatorships. So as long as the regime is delivering for people, it helps to stabilize the regime.
Yeah.
But when the music stops playing, people get unhappy very quickly.
Money aside, Yasha doesn't think China, or anyone else for that matter, is offering a true alternative to liberal democracy.
I think it's impossible to copy or to emulate, which is to say that if you wanted to emulate and copy China, how would you even start going about doing that? You'd have to have a sort of communist party that's been lying around for 60 or 70 years, that secretly morphed into a weird state capitalist enterprise. Absolutely unclear what the next step would be.
So it's not as easy as just exporting the model around the world. But when it comes to autocracy, well, there are a lot of options for what model a country might choose.
What I do worry about is that Russia and particularly China could over time become sponsors for any form of autocratic government, where they value stability and loyalty over certain values of like liberal democracy that would make for much bigger headwinds for democracy around the world.
Remember when I mentioned that the Peace Corps came to China in 1993? A sign of improving relations? Well, while we were working on this episode, the Peace Corps pulled all of its volunteers. Then the pandemic hit. And in the U.S., there was the murder of George Floyd. Connie says her friends' nationalistic tone has only gotten stronger through all of this. She actually shared an online joke that's been going around. It compares the pandemic to a school exam. China aces it in less than an hour. Japan and South Korea are overwhelmed, but they finish it with China's help. Italy claims the test is too hard. Iran passes out. Then the examiner announces it's an open book test. The United States passes its test to China for help. Recently, Connie's mom told her, thank goodness you're back in China. People in America don't obey their government. You could have been infected there. The last time Connie sent a message to her friends on WeChat was to wish them a happy holiday during the Lunar New Year. Nobody replied. Things That Go Boom is produced by Inkstick Media and distributed by PRX. Our show is produced by Ruth Morris, Marin Lazian, and me. Darian Shulman composes our music, and our engineer is Robin Wise. Thanks to John Barth for his editorial support. And thanks to Connie, who is working on a memoir about how it's getting more and more difficult to straddle the divide between the U.S. and China. Connie, just so you know, we reached out to Leo to see if he might be willing to make a little cameo here, but his agent very politely and very quickly turned us down. Last but definitely not least, thanks to the foundations that make our work possible, the Carnegie Corporation of New York, MacArthur Foundation, and Square and Plowshares Fund, as well as Inkstick supporters, including the Coulomb Foundation, Prospect Hill Foundation, and the Jubitz Family Foundation. If you like the show, please leave us a nice review on your favorite app. We love to hear from you. You can also visit us on social at Inkstick Media and have a look at the rest of the work that we do. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
I really want to learn more about 80s in America because, you know, everyone talks about the 60s and the 70s.
Oh, America in the 80s was good. Oh, it was like a lot of big, big hair and power ballads. And...
From PRX. From PRX.